January. A happy new year to you all, my dearest family, which of course includes Mr. L and a young man by the name of Teddy. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed your Christmas bundle, for I didn't get it till night and had given up hoping. Your letter came in the morning, but you said nothing about a parcel, meaning it for a surprise, so I was disappointed, for I had a kind of feeling that you wouldn't forget me. I felt a little low in my mind as I sat up in my room after tea, and when the big, muddy, battered-looking bundle was brought to me, I just hugged it and pranced. It was so homey and refreshing that I sat down on the floor and read and looked and ate and laughed and cried in my usual absurd way. The things were just what I wanted, and all the better for being made instead of bought. Beth's new ink bib was capital, and Hannah's box of hard gingerbread will be a treasure. I'll be sure and wear the nice flannels you sent, Marmy, and read carefully the books Father has marked. Thank you all, heaps and heaps. Speaking of books reminds me that I'm getting rich in that line, for on New Year's Day Mr. Bear gave me a fine Shakespeare. It is one he values much, and I've often admired it, set up in the place of honour with his German Bible, Plato, Homer, and Milton. So you may imagine how I felt when he brought it down, without its cover, and showed me my name in it, from my friend Friedrich Bär. You say often you wish a library? Here I give you one, for between these lids, he meant covers, is many books in one. Read him well, and he will help you much, for the study of character in this book will help you to read it in the world and paint it with your pen. I thanked him as well as I could, and talk now about my library as if I had 100 books. I never knew how much there was in Shakespeare before, but then I never had a Bear to explain it to me. Now don't laugh at his horrid name. It isn't pronounced either Bear or Beer, as people will say it, but something between the two, as only Germans can give it. I'm glad you both like what I tell you about him, and hope you will know him some day. Mother would admire his warm heart, Father his wise head. I admire both, and feel rich in my new friend Friedrich Bär. Not having much money, or knowing what he'd like, I got several little things and put them about the room, where he would find them unexpectedly. They were useful, pretty, or funny. A new Standish on his table, a little vase for his flower, he always has one, or a bit of green in a glass to keep him fresh, he says, and a holder for his blower, so that he needn't burn up what Amy calls mouchoirs. I made it like those Beth invented, a big butterfly with a fat body and black and yellow wings, worsted feelers and bead eyes. It took his fancy immensely, and he put it on his mantelpiece as an article of vertu, so it was rather a failure after all. Poor as he is, he didn't forget a servant or a child in the house, and not a soul here, from the French laundry woman to Miss Norton, forgot him. I was so glad of that. They got up a masquerade, and had a gay time New Year's Eve. I didn't mean to go down, having no dress, but at the last minute Mrs. Kirk remembered some old brocades, and Miss Norton lent me lace and feathers. So I dressed up as Mrs. Malaprop and sailed in with a mask on. No one knew me, for I disguised my voice, and no one dreamed of the silent, haughty Miss March, for they think I am very stiff and cool, most of them, and so I am to whippersnappers, could dance and dress, and burst out into a nice derangement of epitaphs, like an allegory on the banks of the Nile. I enjoyed it very much, and when we unmasked, it was fun to see them stare at me. I heard one of the young men tell another that he knew I'd been an actress. In fact, he thought he remembered seeing me at one of the minor theatres. Meg will relish that joke. Mr. Bear was Nick Bottom, and Tina was Titania, a perfect little fairy in his arms. To see them dance was quite a landscape, to use a Teddyism. I had a very happy New Year after all. And when I thought it over in my room, I felt as if I was getting on a little in spite of my many failures. For I'm cheerful all the time now, work with a will, and take more interest in other people than I used to, which is satisfactory. Bless you all. Ever your loving, Joe. Chapter 34. A Friend. Though very happy in the social atmosphere about her, and very busy with the daily work that earned her bread and made it sweeter for the effort, Jo still found time for literary labours. The purpose which now took possession of her was a natural one to a poor and ambitious girl, but the means she took to gain her end were not the best. She saw that money conferred power. Money and power, therefore, she resolved to have, not to be used for herself alone, but for those whom she loved more than self. The dream of filling home with comforts, giving Beth everything she wanted, from strawberries in winter to an organ in her bedroom, going abroad herself, and always having more than enough, so that she might indulge in the luxury of charity, had been for years Joe's most cherished castle in the air. The prize story experience had seemed to open a way which might, after long travelling and much uphill work, lead to this delightful Chateau en Espagne. But the novel disaster quenched her courage for a time, for public opinion is a giant which has frightened stouter-hearted jacks on bigger beanstalks than hers. Like that immortal hero, she reposed a while after the first attempt, which resulted in a tumble and the least lovely of the giant's treasures, if I remember rightly. But the up-again-and-take-another spirit was as strong in Joe as in Jack, so she scrambled up on the shady side this time and got more booty, but nearly left behind her what was far more precious than the money bags. She took to writing sensation stories, for in those dark ages even all perfect America read rubbish. She told no one, but concocted a thrilling tale, and boldly carried it herself to Mr. Dashwood, editor of the Weekly Volcano. She had never read Sartor Resartus, but she had a womanly instinct that clothes possess an influence more powerful over many than the worth of character or the magic of manners. So she dressed herself in her best, and trying to persuade herself that she was neither excited nor nervous, bravely climbed two pairs of dark and dirty stairs to find herself in a disorderly room, a cloud of cigar smoke, and the presence of three gentlemen, sitting with their heels rather higher than their hats, which articles of dress none of them took the trouble to remove on her appearance. Somewhat daunted by this reception, Jo hesitated on the threshold, murmuring in much embarrassment, "Excuse me, I was looking for the Weekly Volcano office. I wished to see Mr. Dashwood." Down went the highest pair of heels, up rose the smokiest gentleman, and carefully cherishing his cigar between his fingers, he advanced with a nod and a countenance expressive of nothing but sleep. Feeling that she must get through the matter somehow, Jo produced her manuscript, and blushing redder and redder with each sentence, blundered out fragments of the little speech carefully prepared for the occasion. "A friend of mine desired me to offer a story, just as an experiment. Would like your opinion. Be glad to write more if this suits." While she blushed and blundered, Mr. Dashwood had taken the manuscript, and was turning over the leaves with a pair of rather dirty fingers, and casting critical glances up and down the neat pages. "Not a first attempt, I take it?" Observing that the pages were numbered, covered only on one side, and not tied up with a ribbon, sure sign of a novice. "No, sir. She has had some experience, and got a prize for a tale in the Blarneystone Banner." "Oh, did she?" And Mr. Dashwood gave Jo a quick look, which seemed to take note of everything she had on, from the bow in her bonnet to the buttons on her boots. "Well, you can leave it if you like. We've more of this sort of thing on hand than we know what to do with at present, but I'll run my eye over it and give you an answer next week." Now, Jo did not like to leave it, for Mr. Dashwood didn't suit her at all. But under the circumstances, there was nothing for her to do but bow and walk away, looking particularly tall and dignified, as she was apt to do when nettled or abashed. Just then she was both, for it was perfectly evident from the knowing glances exchanged among the gentlemen that her little fiction of my friend was considered a good joke. And a laugh, produced by some inaudible remark of the editor as he closed the door, completed her discomfiture. Half resolving never to return, she went home and worked off her irritation by stitching pinafores vigorously, and in an hour or two was cool enough to laugh over the scene and long for next week. When she went again,
Mr. Dashwood was alone, whereat she rejoiced. Mr. Dashwood was much wider awake than before, which was agreeable, and Mr. Dashwood was not too deeply absorbed in a cigar to remember his manners. So the second interview was much more comfortable than the first.